The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Listen, folks, I can only work with what I have here, OK? So I'll give you the papers briefly. January's not getting any better, though. Daily Mail probably sums it up in bullet points. Their headline, blow to vaccine rollout, and then Taoiseach rules out closing border, lockdown to continue until March, UK strain of virus is more deadly, deliveries of game changer jab cut. The Irish Times, tighter restrictions on travel and quarantine expected next week. So the EU is preparing new travel curbs. We've heard talk of that. And Belgium has banned non-essential trips in and out of the state. And we are looking at tightening up here as well, as you've been hearing over the last 24 hours. The Irish Examiner focuses on vaccine delivery delayed. That's the AstraZeneca supply. Financial Times is saying could be down by as much as 60%. I think I saw Norway saying they're only getting 18% of what they were meant to be getting. Norway have their own deal, not part of the EU deal, obviously. The Independent, passengers to face 5-day quarantine in hotel, and there's talk that hotels like City West in Dublin could be these, you know, quarantine centres where people are obliged to go. The Herald, Michal declares quar, Taoiseach's tough new COVID rules for travellers. The Irish Daily Star has a story about one of the Kinahan gang, and the Irish Daily Mirror, Conor McGregor is getting $30 million for his massive USC comeback in the Middle East. And the Irish Sun, lockdown is hard on all families, and that's Micheál Martin opens up on COVID stresses. And indeed, the man who is on the front of a lot of the papers today in different ways is joining me now. Taoiseach Micheál Martin, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
Taoiseach, we spoke last in September, and the first thing I said to you was, were you worried? And you were quite worried at that point. We're in much darker times now. How worried are you now?
I'm very worried with the emergence of the variants. And at the European meeting on Thursday evening, that sense of anxiety and, dare I say, fear about the impact of variants on the trajectory of travel, if you like, in terms of dealing with this COVID-19 crisis, because there's two issues here. One is there's a race against time. That phrase was used continually during the meeting. The race against time, on the one hand, the vaccination rollout. On the other hand, the degree to which the variant will impact on transmissibility, on severity of the illness now because of yesterday's revelations, but also the potential of new variants to undermine the vaccine efficacy.
Yeah, so the sooner we need to shut this down and not allow those chances to develop.
Because this could, particularly in the South African variant and on the Brazilian variants, the jury is out. Research is not comprehensive enough to say whether or not the vaccine can respond. There's a confidence that it can respond to the UK variant and will. That's particularly the Pfizer-BioNTech one. That said, science has moved very quickly in terms of vaccinations, and we should remember that. What normally takes 10 years took 10 months to develop vaccines, so it's been a great achievement for science.
Yeah, but
so
are we being let down now by the manufacturer? And we're seeing Johnson delayed until April. We're seeing AstraZeneca, our own game changer, which to be our game changer,
it was.
Big delays there.
I'm concerned about that as well, because and there are contractual arrangements between the European Commission and AstraZeneca, and I expect some very robust meetings in the coming days and engagements between the European Commission and AstraZeneca. The one Pfizer-BioNTech has, broadly speaking, delivered in accordance with their timelines. There was a disruption this week because of their expanding its manufacturing capacity to get more. So Pfizer will deliver contractually on Q1. We'll get more of Pfizer in Q2. But you are correct. AstraZeneca, combined with extra volumes of Pfizer-BioNTech, was going to be the catalyst for us to move from what is a low level of administration of vaccine to a mass vaccination situation. And Johnson & Johnson were to come after that then. And we would, towards the end of quarter two, we would have been in a mass vaccination scenario. That is still our objective.
Europe not has, until the end of quarter two. Into mass vaccinations.
Into mass vaccinations, yeah. Well,
okay.
I thought about April, May, June were going to be key months, Brendan. Okay.
Okay.
And part of those key months would have been AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, plus Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna. On Pfizer-BioNTech, Europe took options recently for an extra 200 million. We immediately signed up for the, our allocation of that. I was insistent on that because we have to anticipate these kinds of jeopardies. They'll come. First of all, we're doing well in Pfizer-BioNTech in terms of supplies into Ireland. I have to say that in terms of...
I will be getting 40,000 a week, which is net equivalent of 20,000 people
the delivery
vaccinated.
I'm saying in terms of what they've promised and committed.
Okay. And so what's that going to go up?
They will honour, but I think...
Do we know what that will go up to?
We do, yeah. In April and May, that will go up significantly. Again, in terms of the actual volumes, but on its own, it won't do our max vaccination. But what it would enable us to do is to cut into the over 85 groups.
Are the over 85s delayed now, do we think?
I think the over 70s more generally will be delayed because of AstraZeneca.
Until when?
Well, it depends on these negotiations and discussions. Okay. Remember...
They'll be very, very anxious to hear that now because I know so many people of that age group and you know it yourself. They're living for this, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's the only thing keeping them going, you know.
By Sunday, we will have all the long-term... Most of the majority of the long-term care residents done with their staff, okay? And then we'll have about half of frontline healthcare workers done by Sunday, tomorrow. And then we were going to move out to the broader population, finish off the frontline healthcare workers and move out to the broader population. We're also beginning the second dose, which we believe is important. We don't believe in this idea of stretching out the gap between the first dose and the second dose. We think for maximum vaccine efficacy. Again, we want to do it within the data and the research that the companies undertook in terms and that the EMA are suggesting.
Think there'll be considerable anxiety among the over 70s and say that over 85 cohort who were expecting to be the first, and a lot of them I know were expecting that in February they would be seeing their vaccinations. Is that not that, what,
no,
that's
just think
going
we need,
out to March now?
I think we need just to, like, this isn't breaking news.
Okay.
When Pfizer said last week we were going to, like, Pfizer said we were going to interrupt supplies for 3 weeks, the commission engaged and said to Pfizer, you know, we have contractual arrangements. This isn't good enough. Can't be done. Pfizer, in fairness, came back and said, okay, we'll interrupt for a week and we'll make up extra supplies once we have the manufacturing capacity expanded. So let's allow some degree of engagement now, and it'll be robust, I imagine, between the Commission and AstraZeneca on this issue.
Because the UK are not going to see any interruption in supply of
AstraZeneca. I've seen that, and these are contractual arrangements that we've entered into. Europe has entered into contractual arrangements with five consortia around vaccines, and I think wisely so.
What do you think of the Minister for Health said the other day that every citizen will be done by September, which I presume he means every adult. Are we actually on track for that?
That's in accordance with our scheduling, and both in terms of delivery of vaccine and in terms of rollout. I mean, we were waiting for the authorisation of AstraZeneca. And then at that stage, we would be in a position to announce to the public the broad details of our vaccination programme.
But AstraZeneca now was 200,000 doses a month.
Yeah.
That's 100,000 people a month.
Yeah.
So between now and September, that hits less than a million people. Where were 3.5, 3.6 million adults getting...
We have Johnson & Johnson coming on stream.
Okay.
We have more Pfizer-BioNTech coming on stream, volumes. We actually would have been in a surplus of vaccines.
Eventually,
Europe would have been, and then the issue was what you do with the surplus afterwards. But and in other words, as Ursula von der Leyen said the other night, and as I've been saying, our problem in January, February has been delivery. Okay, not getting enough vaccine into the country. I mean, we had about a delivery of 150,000 vaccines up to the beginning of this week. By the end of this week, we'll have 147,000 administered. So you can see there's very little in the tank. So we're giving it out as fast as we get it in. We were moving from a delivery issue to quarter two to becoming an administration issue for us as a country. Can we roll it out as fast as we want to roll it out? Now AstraZeneca puts a real problem in our midst, but we're going to have to deal with it and see what else we can do.
Okay. Now, the immediate situation that I think is on people's minds as well is you've now said you're extending the current restrictions, and that was the worst kept secret going for the last week. You talk about taking stock every 4 weeks. So say we take stock again at the end of February. what would you like to see at the end of February that might allow us to kind of rethink the situation?
I'd like to see figures well down, well down, very low.
Like what kind of case numbers would you like
to see? About, I mean, there's two things. First of all, the case numbers have to be well below, have to be in the hundreds, if not 100 to 2, you know, that low.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that a variant is what my concern is, because if it is as transmissible and it's now the dominant, will become the dominant variant in here, it's at 62% of all cases. That means it transmits more easily. If we have mass mobilization and socialization, it will spread again. I think with the vaccines coming, there's an argument to be cautious and conservative now for the first half of this year until we roll out the vaccine.
So are you saying that we stay in some form of a lockdown for the first half of the year?
I think we will be witnessing far more prolonged restrictions than we have to date.
Restrictions as harsh as we have right now?
Yes, potentially,
Really?
Well, now, obviously, look, I'm the Taoiseach, I accept, but I have to consult with my colleagues and ministers, and we'll consult with the opposition as well. But that is my sense of it until we get control and get a sense in terms of how the virus is mutating and the impact of these variants. I mean, British science is good. British science has been following this more than anybody else for the last number of months. And I've been following some of their research, and I've been talking to people here as well who are experts in this field. And, you know, I take seriously what emerges from Britain in terms of the latest research on the variant. That's what gives me the most concern. And therefore, we have to now be very conservative about this for the first half of the year.
So is what you're saying that this is not the game it was before, where we get it down a bit and then we start easing things up? Really now, it's about holding out for the vaccination to kick in.
Yes, and human behaviour will defeat this virus. So that means restrictions. And that means watching everything we do, irrespective of the setting we are in. You know, the good news is that the people are adhering. You know, we're down to contacts of two, which is a very good news. But human behaviour will defeat it.
Hard to keep that
it's
up
very
for
hard.
6 months,
it's very
it?
Hard. It's very, very hard. And that's where the vaccination comes in. You know, even by Sunday, there will be an impact on reducing mortality over time and serious illness by the administration of the vaccine. And so the more and more people we get vaccinated, particularly in the more vulnerable groupings, the better for all of us in society.
So are you saying that if we get that critical mass of, I don't know, is it 15, 20% of the population done, and presumably your deaths plummet by 90%, some people say, are you saying that is then when we can start thinking about easing up?
Just to say to you on that, I mean, we have to be careful about how we understand the role of the vaccine. I mean, public health expertise is concerned about certain perceptions of the vaccine, that it gives us the freedom to do everything we want to do. The research on the vaccine is it prevents serious illness and it prevents mortality. The evidence isn't there yet that it stops you from transmitting it to somebody else. So there's a fair degree of caution around that. And you've heard talk about vaccine passports and all of that. I mean, at the European Council meeting, the majority opinion was against the idea of a vaccine passport. More so, we agreed on the idea of having an interoperable, standardised model whereby we would have we'd have vaccine certificates on medical grounds only. That this is to medically certify that you've had a vaccine. That's its only application and should be its only application right through to 2021. So a lot of caution around this idea.
Okay. So now what we're saying is that you're looking at 6 months potentially in and around the current restrictions of where we're at. And even then, if we have a substantial amount of vaccination done, that's not necessarily, to use the phrase we've been using, the game changer that we think it is, vaccination.
No, it's a very significant change in terms of reducing mortality, reducing illness and that. But there is a sense that we do need to say to people, it doesn't stop you from transmitting it to somebody else. I'm not saying there's a 6 month lockdown, by the way. I'm saying simply we will have conservative and cautious approach to reopening. And we'll be looking at this every 4 weeks, but it will be on the conservative, cautious side.
Okay. And
more restrictions.
The supports there for people and for businesses and everything will stay as long as
they will
need
stay.
To stay.
They will stay. And you know, we have budgeted for this eventuality for 2021 in the budget we did, but it will stretch the COVID contingency funds that we've put in place in the budget. But we all departments have had reserves allocated to them in the context of COVID-19. We do have to do everything we possibly can to keep businesses intact during these very severe restrictions, so that when we get past COVID-19, and we will, that we can reboot the economy and keep, and that those businesses can rejuvenate and develop. And we,
when is that? When is that going to be? Have, do you think? If you
I think,
were a betting man,
I would still say that. By the way, by the summer we'll be in a changed environment.
Okay.
I think we will have more options, We will have greater maneuverability in terms of decision making because of the large scale vaccination that will have been achieved by then. But I am sounding here this morning, and you can pick it up, caution and a yeah. conservative approach now, because of how the virus is evolving.
Yeah, and look, that's hard to hear, but I think people will appreciate you being straight with them, because yeah. that's really the way to be right now, isn't it? Listen, you mentioned the European Council meeting. Do I get the impression that we were the kind of poster boy for Europe? Mm. Are we now the case study for Europe? Is it us and our experience with the UK variant that has given Europe the collie wobbles that it has now?
To a degree, yes, but yeah. also the variant is in Europe. And there's a very good article in Der Spiegel recently about when Chancellor Merkel saw her figures going up and they did research themselves, they discovered a variant in Germany. The problem across Europe is most member states don't have genomic sequencing capacity to the degree that they should. And so they're behind in terms of identifying the prevalence of the variants in their respective member states. Now, that was one of the conclusions of the meeting, is that we need to significantly increase genomic sequencing across Europe.
We slipped up very badly letting all those people in from the UK before Christmas and over Christmas, didn't we?
Well, yeah, I think
you're nodding.
In retrospect, I think people didn't see that variant coming in that volume as well. But I think
we knew things were very bad in the southeast of England and London early in December, didn't we? Like, and the variant had been mentioned in mid December and notified to the WHO, but we.
Yeah,
I think ahead.
Well, I think from my sense of it, the full enormity of the variant wasn't the alarm bells weren't ringing as maybe early as they could have. But I think it was the 21st of December that, or yeah. in fairness, our authorities would be notified
by. Did we not have
a
fair idea before that that things were bad in England?
I think, looking back, if you let me, right?
Yeah. Eamon Ryan, this is the kind of stuff that we were saying before Christmas. Air passengers are the best people to make a call on whether they really need to travel. He doesn't think it's up to the government. They won't want to bring home the risk of the virus to their loved ones. I think people have to use their own judgment. I think we should respect that. Like, when we look back on that now, that was kind of deluded stuff, wasn't it?
I think if we knew now what we, if we knew then what we know now, we certainly wouldn't have been doing that. I'd have to say that. And and I think we had a severe lockdown from November right into December, and probably lulled us into a false sense of complacency. Numbers had come down. There's a general view that we would move to level three. Level three does mean broad range of socialisation and all of that. And notwithstanding the fact, even before that, level five for the 6 weeks, we had level three max. We've been on prolonged period of restrictions of one sort or another, bar maybe 2 months during the summer. And fatigue has settled in at that stage.
It can't be a reactive kind of thing based on public opinion or what.
No, I think we've got to learn lessons from this.
Yeah.
I acknowledge that.
Yeah.
And I certainly, you know, I examine this every day and reflect on this.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
We certainly wouldn't have been making decisions coming out of that level five then, given what has happened.
Did you read about Belmullet over
the
last day or two? Like, and I mean, and I presume, have you heard these stories as well? I've heard them from West Cork and towns all over the country, that a lot of people came home from England, and this seems to have happened in Belmullet from a number of sources. People came home from England, didn't even pretend to isolate.
I've heard those anecdotes. I've heard of lock-ins on Christmas Eve when it was supposed to be shut down. Like, there's been a number of super spreader events as well. You know, funerals have been problematic in some areas. Generally speaking, I think there was that sense abroad that we were in a better space than and an underestimation of the virus. I mean, I didn't think
you were convinced. I thought there was a very telling moment in the press conference after he announced the easing of restrictions for Christmas, when Leo Varadkar was asked what he was going to do. And he said he was going to the gym, he was getting a haircut, and he was going out for dinner that weekend with friends. And you were asked, and you talked about having a very quiet Christmas at home with the family, and there was no question of going in there. Were you not convinced yourself at that point that we were doing the right thing?
No, I've been cautious individually. I think that was more personal context.
Was it? Yeah.
And family
Did anyone express misgivings? Did you express misgivings about opening up?
So around the table, there's a variety of debate all of the time. But we have to.
Was there anyone saying this is madness? We shouldn't be.
No one was saying this. Everyone was saying we got to level 3.
Okay. Yeah. Including the effort and fairness.
I don't want to. You know, people are different. The one different perspective was on the hospitality versus the households issue, you know, the mixing of households. I don't think anyone saw the level, Brendan, of 6,000 a day. There was an expectation when, for example, it was presented to us that we should move into level 5 in October. There was an expectation that we would be going back into a 3-week lockdown in January, but that the numbers would be, the modelling was...
Or 400, like we were talking about.
With a couple of hundreds or whatever. That we would... Because there was also a sense of human behavioural analysis informing this, that basically, you know, there would be in socialisation around Christmas, no matter what you say, no matter what government tries to do, people are going... There's an inevitability about what would happen over Christmas. I mean, the household context is important. No, they would have brought it in from the community into households, but there would have been... people tell me that they can see cases 10 days on from Christmas Day and from New Year's Day, where there was significant
and whole extended going families,
on and all of that coming on. We've got to learn from it. And
what you've learned is that you're going to be much more cautious and conservative going forward.
Absolutely, particularly given that we have a vaccination rollout. Remember, like the one concern I have, other concerns, which we had back then, to be fair to all concerned, you were talking about views around the table, mental health was looming large.
Yeah.
We were getting a lot of warnings about domestic violence, about mental health among young people, all of the NGOs and mental health were saying their numbers are going through the roof in terms of inquiries from anxiety, stress from kids and so on like that. So all of that goes into the mix as well, and the unemployment issue and people who are without a job and so on.
Now, but I suppose people would feel that one reason that we have ended up the way we have is because, like, the monitoring of people coming into the country. I mean, Aoife McLeod had a good phrase yesterday, half measures, like she said. And it's been a joke, really, hasn't it? Like, half people not putting addresses on the passenger locator form, only 10% of them being followed up. I mean, Mary Favier saying it yesterday, that health workers get very demoralised when they see that they've stepped up the way they have. And then there's people coming into the country kind of willy-nilly. Why didn't we enforce that properly?
Well, first of all, numbers in travel have been dramatically lower than any...
But you don't need that many.
No,
you don't need that many to bring in the English variant.
The next point, the majority of people coming in are Irish people, by the way, who are going off. The people still over Christmas went on holidays abroad. Difficult to comprehend that, Brendan.
Yeah.
Well, we're now looking at the Gardaí doing checks on airports now and saying, like, why are you going on holidays? You shouldn't be going on holidays. You shouldn't be outside your 5 kilometre.
Yeah, the Gardaí also left in 80 people without PCR tests last week, didn't they? And let them
We're going to move on that. There will be quarantining for those coming in.
There'll be quarantining for those coming in without a PCR test.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But NPHET has been quite clear that one PCR test 3 days before arrival is not sufficient.
And we get that. Many of these measures are deterrents as well to stop people from travelling in the first place. We don't want people travelling, period. We just don't think people should travel right now, except for absolutely essential purposes. Forget travel. You shouldn't be going to your property abroad if you have one, or you shouldn't be going on a holiday. Forget it. And we're also looking at other travel restrictions then in terms of people from other countries coming into Ireland and quarantining options. When all that will go to the Cabinet COVID Committee on Monday. I can't preempt them all. There'll be discussions around that.
But as we understand it, what's going to happen is that if somebody has a PCR test within 72 hours, they can come into the country unless they're from, say, Brazil or South Africa. If they don't have a PCR test, they will be put into a mandatory quarantine. And you're not going to go any further than that.
We're looking at other options additional to that.
Can you tell me what options you're looking at?
Well, I think we're looking at other quarantining options for certain countries where, for example, South Africa or Brazil, for example. And we're looking at other issues as well. Just to say... 1,000 came in, we'd say, on Thursday. Okay, right. 1,000 people would have come in. Only one didn't have a PCR negative test. I'm now getting complaints, and TDs rang me yesterday. People are now complaining. I was not allowed on a plane, someone from South Africa. I wasn't allowed on a plane because someone said I didn't have a PCR test. They wouldn't let me on. The same, we're getting communications from Spain and elsewhere. You know, my family member wasn't allowed on a plane. So already that is having impact. And the one objective of this is to deter people, just to make it so goddamn awkward you won't be bothered travelling, and so on in the first instance. The second one is your point. I take the point that there has to be more better follow through in terms of people coming in. But the majority, it would appear from the analysis, are Irish people who went abroad over Christmas for holidays and who are coming back.
Okay, which they shouldn't have done. But yeah, all right. Come here, is zero, there's been a clamour again now the last few days. Yeah. The zero COVID people are up, and you know, is it starting to look more attractive if the alternative is this? Like, if we get to the position again where we were last summer, we were down to single figures. Should we have pursued the zero COVID then? Harsh, fairly strict measures on the borders and keep it out of here.
Well, we've never been advised to do that, by the way. And there's different views from different ranges of expertise, to
but
be fair.
But NPHET do have been looking for a mandatory quarantine long time, which would feed into a zero COVID.
But not a zero COVID strategy.
Yeah.
They have never advocated a zero COVID strategy. I don't think it's practical or doable.
Because of the North?
Because of, there's the number of factors or geographic location. I think we should never understate the seamless interactivity between UK and Ireland. Even when we banned travel, and we did ban travel over Christmas, once the news emerged, when the UK banned internal travel,
very quickly
we banned it straight away. But already we had to scramble charter planes then to get people back, and they were all over. They were in Britain for all a variety of reasons, and there is that unfortunate, not unfortunate, it's history. But in terms of the public health, it's difficult. The North is a difficulty. My understanding is the North isn't testing for the variant. You know, when I've discussed this with the Northern leaders, their view is, the variant doesn't appear to be as big an issue in the North, which is just not. I can't understand that. So the North is an issue in terms of the capacity to seal the entire border. There are two different political in terms of authorities. There's the executive there. They've had real issues within the executive. I don't want to be in any way political about it. Some people, I think, rather simplistically say, oh, you know, get your act together there and sort out the North and the Republic and get into alignment. It's just simply not that simple because of political issues.
So what's the two island strategy then? What does that look like even? I know it's embryonic.
It's very embryonic, yeah.
What
it might look like, you see, basically, we have a gap. If people travel from the UK into Belfast, we can do all we like in Dublin. But they'll come south and they'll take an easier option. So we bring in restrictions and we bring in quarantining in Dublin. But people say, OK, I'll go to Belfast and come into the Republic that way. That is problematic. So I think a UK-Irish approach, potentially, would you ring-fence the two islands?
And you were talking to Boris Johnson last night, was it?
I did. I rang him about the research, just so there are science people. And in fairness, there are people in have been engaging with their people on various research and so on. So I just asked him what's his sense of it in terms of the research and what they call their nerve tag organization, which on the science side have produced this report, sent it to him, which said basically there's a 30% potential greater chance of dying from this new variant, which would mean if instead of 10 out of 1,000, it could be 13 out of 1,000. And but he said, you know, they're going to do more research on that. He is worried about the variant, and he has, you know, there's something going on out there, is what a layperson would say. Many people in hospitals have been saying this to me for the last month. This is different.
Saying what, really?
This is in terms of
sicker.
Whole wards getting infected, which didn't happen in the second wave and the first wave. No, the public health will have a different perspective. Their view is that it's a higher volume, so therefore that's going to naturally happen. People on the ground are saying to us that they haven't quite experienced this. HSC personnel are saying that they've never quite experienced this, over the 10 months of the pandemic.
And this is why the hospital outbreaks might be so bad right now.
That's my sense of it.
Right.
That's my sense of it. I mean, some people in infectious diseases said to me, you know, one person in a ward, suddenly six have it and rapidly have it. By the way, I just have to say, you know, the frontline healthcare workers have been truly heroic. This is going on now for 10 months. They're on the front line. It is extraordinary work that they're doing on behalf of the country. And I think that really means all of us then have to really knuckle down and just adhere to the guidelines and the restrictions. Because, you know, I would worry about burnout. I just think they're at it nonstop. The numbers are high. I think they've come down a bit in the general hospitalisation this morning. Hopefully we're going to plateau in the next week in relation to that.
So we might have dodged the bullet again.
No, we haven't. It's very serious.
But in terms of it becoming overwhelming and too much.
I think the winter initiative has worked. I think some of the innovations, for example, the capacity to transfer from hospital to hospital is because of investment in mobile, you know, ambulance service, which is high spec and so on. I think the investment in the flow in hospitals is much better in the ordinary non-COVID stuff, so that people are coming out, getting out of hospital, getting their step done much quicker. So notwithstanding all of the COVID and that, the hospitals have been working much better in a non-COVID environment than previously, because we did put a lot of investment in. And we just have to, there are lessons to be learned from that in terms of, you know, investment coupled with reform will work in our health service. But I think the investment has to be of a high order, to be frank. And that's a message, you know, because it does work. And that's what Paul Reid and the HSC are saying to me, that 600 million winter initiative plan has been effective for them in on a range of fronts, from primary care to community care, to the step-down facilities, to the acute facilities.
Okay.
We just have to do more of it.
So some of the big state is going to stay with us after this. Listen, can we talk about the special schools?
Yes.
I mean, that was a disaster, wasn't it? I mean, twice marching those parents and those families up to the top of the hill, giving them hope, and then bang again. You know what I thought was kind of one of the very unfortunate things about it was to see people having to come on the radio, air their family business and their private stuff, and then them being pitted against each other. And, you know, any family will tell you that the SNAs are such, they are such a valuable ally to that family and everything. See them all pitted against each other like that, played out in the media. It was a failure of politics to let that happen, wasn't it, to those people?
I think it was a failure all round. I think, to be fair to politics and government, that we didn't, this wasn't a unilateral move by government. You know, I think there was a shared view that we should try and provide for children with special needs. When I say shared, I mean among all the partners in education. When that initial row happened, they all knuckled down together and said, okay, we agree.
On Friday, the letter came out and it was agreed. What happened then?
My sense is what happened, and I said this in the Dáil, I think all the union leaders acted in good faith. When the previous week, they had announced that their members would be in schools the following week. There's a lot of fear and anxiety out there in the general population, and that's in the general teaching population as well, because of what we've just discussed about, they see the hospital numbers going up, they see the issue around the variant. And I think there was a mismatch between, if you like, people in the leadership position genuinely want to try and organise something, and people saying not yet, not just yet, and concerns around public health. And notwithstanding the fact that Kevin Kelleher and Abby Collins, who've been with schools from the very beginning since we opened them, did the webinar, and Ronan Glynn, and people spoke about schools themselves being safe environments.
But the webinar seems to be the thing that really put the kibosh on it.
Well, when you think that 16,000 people signed in on it, that illustrates something, doesn't it, in terms of the general anxiety? No.
So who shut the schools? Was it the INTO in force, or who?
Well, I would say, to be fair to all concerned, and I'm speaking to your point, I'm anxious that we don't have this divisiveness. We just have to avoid that at all costs, because you do need that unity between SNA, teacher and family. It can't be one against the other. That's a disaster. So we've got to pull back from all that. And met with the ministry yesterday and the officials. We had a good chat about this. They're working again well with the unions and the management again. And they're thinking through this in terms of, OK, how can we best do this?
When do you think it might happen?
In concert. And I think we're all dedicated to that. I think everyone's been acting in good faith. That's my sense of it.
When do you think it might happen?
I think, I don't want to give a timeline until it's, I don't want to be walking anybody up any hill right now.
Okay.
I just think that there is a shared determination to do something for families with special needs, and children with special needs in particular.
Okay. When might we hear something, do you think?
I would like to think, in certainly in the coming weeks.
In the coming weeks?
I just want to put it that way.
Not in the coming days.
If it comes sooner, fine. But I'm not going to preempt, Brendan, because you've correctly said, you know.
Okay, that's fair
and
enough.
And when that issue, the last second time, that was all that guidance had been agreed by everybody, but people reacted and so on, and we are where we are now in it. But
you said a funny thing.
But I think
thing
it is, can I say, it is our priority.
Okay.
Above and beyond anything in education.
You said about it the other day.
Yeah.
You said maybe we need to wait till the numbers go down a bit. Now, this was not about schools. This was about the special education thing in particular. Do you think yourself it's not safe for them to
go
back?
No, what
right
I was
now?
Reflecting there was the concern out there, the general concern out there that people are nervous because of those numbers, and maybe the timing issue around that, the numbers being high, the concern about the variant and that, I think that was weighing on the minds of many people who are in the sector. And that's what I meant by that.
Okay. And this doesn't bode well for getting all the schools back, does it?
It doesn't. It doesn't. And again, we'll be discussing that on Monday. And on Tuesday, which for me as a teacher, I'm passionate about education.
Yeah.
We throw our heart into it before September. But with a million people involved in our education, I think we're going to have to look at it differently now in terms of how we reopen schools.
What do you mean by that?
Well, not the one big bang approach, because of the transmissibility and that. And I think we have to get the numbers down.
What would you like to see the numbers at for schools to go back?
Well, I think they'll have to be. I mean, they'd have to be somewhere similar to where we were. Now we got through October, November, but relatively high numbers. Got through to December. So I don't want to be specific in terms of the actual numbers, but I think we
would like to be good for people to know what the criteria is there a target like that?
But the
target is
like getting the numbers down to the low hundreds, but also vaccination and all of that.
So for schools, you mentioned a figure earlier of 100 to 200 to look at.
Schools will be different.
Measures.
They're an essential service.
Okay.
Like schools have never, we've seen schools as an essential service, right? So outside the broad sweep of restrictions. But because of where we are now in terms of the pandemic, the idea of mobilising a million people at the one time was the main motivating factor to not reopening them. Schools themselves can be safe, are safe places. In fact, can be safer sometimes for teenagers than outside of school, because they'll mix more outside of school. They will mix more across households outside of school, whereas the schools are controlled environments. And the public health people have been very clear about this. The school environments have been safe environments. That's what the public health people are saying to us. But I understand the general anxiety that's out there among teachers generally.
If we're talking about the restrictions being in place for February as well, would you see schools opening in February, or are we talking March before we even look at it?
Our first priority is the special ed.
Okay, which could happen in February.
Yeah. I'd be looking at special ed first and doing that first.
Okay.
I think
so
more generally...
Would you be surprised if schools were back before Patrick's Day?
The full million won't be back.
Yeah. Okay.
But there may be, you know, we can phase things and look at things, things differently, and just be. We need to think about this, is what I am saying. We need to engage. All need to engage. I think at primary level there's been a fair degree of engagement. I have to say between all of the partners, including the unions, that there's been serious engagement. At post primary level, that will have to happen now. And I know the department are engaging with the partners this week at second level, but we need to be innovative, and we need to just. Obviously, parallel with the way the virus is changing, we need to adapt our approaches then in terms of the mass movement of young people and students as well.
Okay, come here. From everything you've been saying here, the Leaving Cert's not happening, is it?
Well, no, just again, I'm not going to say anything here. There's enough anxiety and stress out there among young people.
But the anxiety and stress is the uncertainty, like to know.
Of course, but any decision we take now has repercussions right through to June, July. I'm a great believer, and one of the impacts on politics I've observed is social media and this huge sense of a decision now or a decision in 24 hours or within a week.
Yeah.
But I get the stress and the anxiety, but anything we decide, we can decide easily enough, but we've got to work it through. And work through the implications for the students, number one, in terms of their situation.
So would you prefer to wait until you have a clearer idea of how things might look in June or July? Is that
No, we're going to engage. The Department of Education, the Minister of Education, will engage with the second level partners now in respect of the Leaving Cert.
So we'll have a decision on that before the month is out, will
it? Oh, yeah, but certainly within a shorter time frame than that. And
Do
I get the need for decisions on this, but there's a range of options that will have to be looked at, examined, and we want to do the best we can in the difficult circumstances for the young people involved.
Listen, the report on the mother and baby homes did not go down well with a lot of survivors, did it?
No, and in terms of the what some term maybe the over legalistic sort of presentation.
I think a failure to be heard, to feel that they were heard, wasn't it? That they were listened to and believed.
The personal testimonies are powerful. And I think they speak the loudest from the report for me. And it's only, to me, it's only the beginning now of a process of healing, recognition, and in terms of one of the ongoing needs of people and survivors, access to information.
Yeah.
Unfettered access to information.
Were you surprised, were you taken aback at how your apology was received?
No, I wasn't. I mean, I got different, I mean, we got a lot of individual correspondents that were appreciative of it, others not so. I think some of it was misinterpreted by some in the political domain. I mean, I made no bones about the culpability of the church and the state in allowing all of this to happen.
Yeah. There is a stand over that as well as a societal issue.
Well, there is a societal context to it, of course. I mean, if you look at the personal testimonies, I thought it was very striking. The priest was called for. The doctor was called for. The nun was involved. A family member would have driven the young mother to the mother and baby home. What is striking is, in some cases, young girls were raped. Either through incest or somebody, no one bothered asking. No one bothered listening to the young mother. No one went to the Gardaí saying a rape has happened here. Who's going to do anything about this? Investigate it and bring those who were responsible for the rape to justice. It is quite shocking.
Hang on, are you suggesting that there was a kind of a conspiracy of silence around families in a lot of cases?
I don't know. Not all of it was family. Some was family, you know, but a lot of it was young 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds in some cases becoming pregnant and no one asking, apparently, you know, from the, no one, well, we know there was very little brought forward to the courts or to the Gardaí reported in the earlier decades and certainly right up. And I find that quite shocking. And I think there was a very perverse attitude to sexuality at the heart of this.
Yeah, but I suppose, you know, which was fueled. Was fueled by the church. Yeah.
Fueled by the church and this kind of perverse moral code.
Did you see that you saw on the front of the Examiner today that a former resident of Bessborough is taking, Caroline Donovan is her name, she's taking the HSE, the Minister for Health, Ireland, the AG and the Order to taking a High Court case against it. Are we going to see a raft of cases like this now? I mean, there's potential for tens of thousands of these cases.
Well, we are, and the Minister, Roderick O'Gorman, is putting departments together to develop a restorative recognition scheme, which will mean financial contributions to people, of course, and that will emerge and that will happen. But others are always free to take cases in respect of their situations. But we will work with survivors, and survivors have to come first. In terms of the measures that we're going to take.
Yeah. There's probably a little bit of work to be done there with survivors, isn't there? There's a lot of hurt from the last week or two.
Oh, an awful lot of hurt. And the big
not the original hurt. There's a lot of hurt for the webinar, the dissemination of the report, you know, all kinds of issues. I think a lot of them feel they were re-traumatised by the whole thing.
Well, I think what we need to do is, we want to do a national, not just a repository centre, but a national centre that tells the story from the perspective of the survivor.
Non-legalistic, not a great piece of academic work, but just, an oral history. There is a Jew oral history.
Yes.
An oral
what
history.
I would like to see is that this generation and future generations of young people will go to this centre, which will be professionally done, and they say, this happened in Ireland. We're not hiding it. And why? Because future generations must never go down this road again. And I did say, you know, in some of my contributions, what this idea of institutionalizing problems and issues and whatever, you know, institutionalization is bad, it seems to me, creates corrupt authority. And in many respects in Ireland, if you go from mental health to the industrial schools, to the Magdalen laundries, to the mother and baby homes, those who were most judgmental, the righteous, if you like, created all of this and said, we're in charge. We know how to sort you out and we know how to run your life.
And, you know, harking back to something we said earlier, that if we don't want people to end up in institutions, the best thing we can do for the people who might end up in institutions now, people who cannot live independently possibly, is give them the tools to live independently. And you know who gives them that? Their families, yes, but their teachers and their SNAs and everything else. And you know that those... A lot of those kids are losing that shot at an independent life. Listen,
that worries me. And also, there's marginal children on the margins out there that TUSLA are looking after. There are kids who fall through the education sector. They're not as transparent out there in the public debate.
Yeah,
but they are the kids of this current generation who could be compared, maybe in some circumstances, to some babies who were born in modern baby homes who ended up in industrial schools. So we need to be self-critical much more than we are of ourselves in the current generation. I'm talking about myself in that regard as well, in terms of marginalised young people and children. And that means, I think, resourcing TUSLA more and resourcing schools that work for children in those circumstances.
There's an email here from Dr. Patricia Keane, who's a GP in Kiltima. Can you ask Taoiseach what additional help can be sent to Belmullet? Highest COVID-19 numbers nationally, no community COVID hub, for example. Is there a team gone into Belmullet?
Well, I think, the HSC do provide additional supports both to sectors like nursing homes. No, they're stretched as well, the HSC at the moment. And they will engage with public health and community health in Belmullet.
And they have descended on Belmullet?
Well, I understand they have, but I mean, I'll engage with them further on that. But Belmullet, the numbers are extraordinary.
There's a huge amount of texters calling for a total lockdown of people travelling in and out of the country. That's the one team that comes through consistently there, but that's not happening.
No, I think there's going to be very severe restrictions. There's very few people coming in, Brendan. And I would say to ourselves, look, I just say to Irish people, do not go on a holiday now, please, for the next while. Just don't travel if you don't have to travel. I mean, when I say have to, I mean, some people have to for essential work purposes. But no one else should be travelling. I mean, the number of people who come back in here will be Irish people who went abroad in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's within our hands.
Yeah.
In terms of human behaviour that I said earlier. And the travel is very important now in the context of the variants, of course it is. But equally, our behaviour, which in fairness, since the lockdown has happened, people are adhering.
Yeah, you're happy.
Broadly speaking, you know.
Okay. You mentioned the mental health thing earlier, and we're all having to look after ourselves and everything. Are you looking after yourself?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
You get to go for a run or keep fitness up or
walking on a Saturday or a Sunday if I get the chance. I try at night when I come out of the office. I try and get my 10,000 steps done if I can. It could be 11 o'clock at night. You might see me wandering around the place, but I try. Doesn't happen every night now because. I walk a lot. I wear a mask when I'm walking, by the way, and I would just simply say.
Do you think people should be wearing a mask?
I do. Yeah, I just want to say that because you know, I just noticed in the marina in Cork, for example, or you could take the daughter here or whatever. You know, there's lots of people now who would have been on Grafton Street before Christmas in large numbers are now on the amenity walk. In large numbers. And I just personally am not an expert. I think people should wear masks in those situations. And it reminds people of course, the crisis we're in, but also I think it does protect. And people like Luke O'Neill and others have been strongly advocating the value of masks on an ongoing basis. And but I do think exercise is very important to mental health. And I think getting out is very important in terms of walking and just.
And you get down to Cork kind of one night a week, do you?
Yeah, I get down tonight now, and see Mary. And Dave and the kids, they're adapting. I think most families are, and I think people are resilient generally. I think nutrition is important as well in terms of mental health and in terms of dealing with this virus. And there's lots to do, even notwithstanding a lockdown.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, I see in the Sun today. You're a fan of The Crown, are you?
Yeah, I do actually. I think it's a very good series. Yeah. I think there's some great episodes in the you know, you go off to Churchill or you the Suez Canal crisis, and there's great sort of insights into historical.
No, we do know, you do know, don't you, that the history, a lot of it is being questioned and everything.
Of course, I do history. Like, yes, the history was my thing before I went into politics, but you rarely get accurate history in a film or in, you know, programs of this kind. But there's a grain there. There's a kind of a...
Are you up to date with it? Have you been watching the Diana years and everything?
No.
Oh, so that treat is ahead of you. Okay, yeah, we won't tell you what happened
there. I don't get a chance to do it as often as I like.
Didn't end well. Okay. Taoiseach Micheál Martin, thank you very much.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.